Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 29.
Chapter 29, we're right in the middle of the action.
Another demon problem. A big one this time.
Pigsy and Sandy are fighting this demon. Now, these guys aren't rookies, are they? They've seen some action.
Definitely not. They're seasoned fighters in their own right.
But the sources say it's a stalemate, even with both of them.
Exactly. And what's really interesting is why. The text is pretty clear. This demon, just way more skilled. On another level entirely.
How much more skilled are we talking?
Well, get this. It suggests that even 20 fighters, like Pigsy and Sandy, they might not even win.
20? Wow. Okay, so that really puts the demon's power into perspective.
It really does. It tells you a lot about the, you know, the power scaling in this story.
So they're somehow holding their own, despite this massive skill gap.
Yeah.
But it sounds like there's something else going on.
Ah, yes. This is where it gets really Journey to the West, doesn't it? Divine intervention. The sources mention all these protector deities.
Yeah, cool.
Oh, a whole lineup. Dharma protectors, the 16 Sixjia, 5 directional deities, 4 duty gods, 18 guardians, basically a celestial support team.
And they're helping Pigsy and Sandy.
Why?
Because Tang Monk has to survive. His mission is destined, right? So these deities are sort of subtly tipping the scales, making sure the fight doesn't end prematurely for the disciples because Tang Monk needs them.
So fate is playing a big hand here, even in the middle of the demon fight.
It's a recurring theme, absolutely. Individual effort matters, but there's this overarching divine plan ensuring the pilgrimage succeeds. They're like celestial bodyguards.
Okay, so while all that's happening outside this epic battle with divine backup,
yeah,
what about Tang Monk? He's stuck inside the demon's cave, right?
Right. And he's not having a good time. He's pretty down, thinking his disciples have probably abandoned him, maybe found some food somewhere.
Huh. Classic Tang Monk paranoia. Always assuming the worst of his disciples.
Pretty much. He's despairing. But then, someone else shows up. A woman.
Unexpected. Who is she? What's she doing there?
Yeah, totally out of the blue. She's described as maybe around 30 years old.
So Tang Monk sees her. What happens? Does he think she's another demon?
Well, he's basically resigned to being eaten at this point. He kind of offers himself up, like, okay, get it over with. But she surprises him. She says, no, I don't eat people. A pretty crucial denial right there.
Definitely. So who is she then?
Okay, so this is the big reveal. She's Princess Bai Hua Xiu, third daughter of the King of Baoxiang Kingdom.
Baoxiang? Where's that?
It's the next kingdom over, basically. About 300 lies west, maybe 100 miles or so.
And how did she end up in a demon's cave?
It's a tragic story. She says the demon kidnapped her 13 years ago.
13 years.
Yeah. Snatched during a moon viewing festival. And, well, he forced her to marry him. She's even had children with him.
Oh, wow. That's incredibly bleak. 13 years held captive.
Absolutely. And you can feel her desperation, her longing to just see her parents again. It really shifts the tone, doesn't it? It's not just a monster fight anymore.
No, it adds this really heavy human element,
yeah,
suffering caused by this demon.
Wow, exactly. So Tang Monk, being Tang Monk, explains his own situation, the mission to get the scriptures, his disciples being caught outside.
And the princess. She sees an opportunity.
She does. It's a moment of hope for her, maybe. She offers to help Tang Monk escape.
Really?
On one condition. He has to carry a letter from her to her parents in Baoxiang.
A letter home after 13 years? That's huge for her, but risky, surely.
Mm.
Helping the demon's prisoner.
Oh, incredibly risky. But you sense her desperation, right? What has she got to lose, really? This is maybe her only chance. It's quite clever, too. Gives Tang Monk a purpose beyond just running away.
And Tang Monk agrees.
Of course. With immense gratitude, the text says. So the princess quickly writes this letter.
But Tang Monk has a point, doesn't he? He's been gone from civilization for a while himself. He worries if he'll even be recognized or if they'll believe him.
That's a fair point. It's been a long time.
How does she reassure him?
She's thought it through. She mentions her father has no sons, implying the daughters are well known. And she thinks her sisters, at least, would recognize her handwriting, maybe details in the letter. She knows her family.
Okay, that makes sense. So the letter is written. How does he actually get out?
Practical advice time. She warns him not to use the front door.
Right, because the big fight is still happening there.
Exactly. The Demon King, Pigsy, Sandy, probably a bunch of lesser demons milling about. Bad idea.
And so what's the alternative?
The back door. And then she tells him to hide in the thorn bushes nearby.
Ouch. Thorn bushes. Well, better than being eaten, I suppose.
Definitely. It shows she's resourceful, thinking practically about his escape route. She really wants this to work.
But she does even more than just give directions, doesn't she? She actually intervenes.
Yes. This part is amazing. She goes outside herself, and then she just calls out directly to the Demon King, uses his name, Yellow Roblad. The Demon King just drops everything and goes right to her.
Huh. So this fearsome demon is kind of wrapped around her finger, or at least attentive.
It seems that way, doesn't it? Maybe some kind of affection, or at least he listens to her.
So what's her plan? How does she convince him to let Tang Lung go?
With a totally made-up story. It's brilliant.
Go on.
She tells him she had a dream. A golden armored god appeared, reminded her of this vow she supposedly made years ago.
A vow.
Yeah, something about sponsoring monks and praying for blessings if she, quote, married well, which
Oh.
is darkly ironic given her situation.
Wow. Okay. So she's using this fake dream.
To ask the Demon King to let Tang Monk go as a way to fulfill this made-up vow. It's like she's using piety as a shield.
Does he buy it?
He agrees.
He disagrees to let his prisoner go.
Yeah, out of respect for her, essentially. Maybe he wants to keep her happy. Maybe he's a little superstitious himself about upsetting gods, even in dreams. Who knows? But he agrees.
Incredible, the power of a well-told lie.
Or maybe the power she holds over him in some way.
So the Demon King tells Pigsy and Sandy the fight's off.
Yep. He basically says, "You guys can go. I'm letting your master go free out of respect for my wife."
Man, Pigsy and Sandy must have been stunned and relieved.
Totally. Utterly baffled, but probably just incredibly grateful to still be in one piece. They don't waste any time.
They run around to the back.
Hightail it straight to the back of the cave, and sure enough, there's Tang Monk hiding exactly where the princess told him to.
Probably covered in scratches from the thorns.
Very likely. Uncomfortable, but alive.
So they grab him and make a run for it.
As fast as they can. The text mentions this mix of feelings relief at escaping, but also this sense of awe at the princess's kindness, the strangeness of it all.
And I bet Pigsy and Sandy had a few things to say.
Oh, you know it. They start grumbling almost immediately, but Tang Monk, ever the mediator, tries to keep the peace.
And they actually make good time, right? They cover that 300
They
line.
do, almost 100 miles, and finally they reach the edge of Boxian Kingdom.
And what's it like after the demon cave in the wilderness?
Ah, the description is just beautiful, a complete contrast. It paints this picture of a thriving grand city.
Give us some details.
Okay. Misty clouds, mountains in the distance, streams, fertile fields, people fishing, gathering wood, then the city itself. Fortified walls, amazing palaces, Taiji Hall, Huagai Hall with jade steps, officials walking around.
Sounds impressive.
Very grand courtyards, gardens, canals, busy streets, but also quiet areas where people hunt. It sounds prosperous, ordered, peaceful. Everything the demon's lair wasn't.
A real beacon of civilization after their ordeal. How do they react arriving there?
Well, Tang Monk feels a connection, apparently. It reminds him of his own home, Chang'an. His heart is stirred.
Makes sense. And the disciples?
Probably just exhausted, happy to have arrived somewhere safe, likely dreaming of a proper rest. They end up settling in at the official guest house.
A much-needed break, I imagine.
Okay, scene change. Tang Monk Huanzang takes up to the gates of the Treasure Elephant Kingdom. Seems pretty standard, right?
Yeah, on the surface, definitely. The first steps are all quite formal, very much by the book. The monk arrives, asks politely to exchange his travel papers, the Wendai.
Right, the
And
Wendai.
you notice he's careful how he speaks to the gatekeeper. The gatekeeper then reports up the chain, tells the king this monk from the great Tang Dynasty has arrived.
And these documents, the Wendai, they're more than just a passport, aren't
Oh,
they?
absolutely. They really represent the emperor's power stretching out all those seals, not just for show. They're a visible symbol of the Tang Empire's influence, which the Treasure Elephant Kingdom clearly respects.
And the king's reaction tells you that straight away. The minute he hears Tang Dynasty and Holy Monk.
He's interested, very interested.
Yeah, immediate audience granted. That says a lot about how prestigious the Tang Empire was, and maybe how people saw this monk too, as someone spiritually significant.
It really does. It highlights the power dynamic between these kingdoms. The Tang Dynasty clearly holds a lot of sway, a lot of prestige in the region.
So when the monk, Xuanzang, finally gets presented at court, you know, makes his formal bows and greetings.
The officials are impressed, you could tell. They're whispering about upper kingdom figures, their rituals and music so refined. It shows this kind of cultural admiration they had for the Tang court.
Like looking up to the big guys.
Exactly. They saw the Tang Dynasty as this center of, civilization and high culture.
So Xuanzang explains his mission, sent by the Tang Emperor, needs scriptures from the West. got exchanged the Wen Dai, all very clear, very official.
And the document itself, the Wen Dai, it gets quite a description, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Issued way back in the 13th year of Zhengwan, 9 imperial seals. It even mentions the backstory. The whole thing with the emperor feeling bad about the Dragon King of Jing River and Guanyin Bodhisattva showing up and setting Xuanzang off.
So it's not just bureaucratic paper, it's got story woven into it.
Precisely. It carries imperial weight and spiritual significance. Putting the emperor's personal history in there kind of legitimizes the whole quest.
Okay, so the king takes it, puts his own seal on it, signs it, all seems wrapped up, diplomatic boxes ticked.
Right. Smooth sailing so far.
But then the monk says, oh, actually, I have something else. And that's where it takes a turn.
That's the pivot. He mentions, almost casually, I've got a letter for the king.
And the king's immediately like, a letter? What letter?
And bam, the bombshell.
This letter, it's about his daughter, the third princess, Bai Hua Xiu, abducted 13 years ago.
By a demon. From the Wave Moon Cave on Bull Mountain. Imagine hearing that after all this time.
13 years. The whole mood in the court must have just plummeted. From polite diplomacy to, wow, this dark, desperate family tragedy.
And the king's reaction? It's raw. Tears, remembering how they searched everywhere, how officials got blamed, servants punished. But nothing. They just thought she was lost.
Vanished without a trace.
Yeah, the idea of a demon. It clearly wasn't on their radar at all. And you have to think, for a king, losing an heir like that, especially maybe supernatural.
It's a bad sign.
Could be seen that way, yeah. Like a shadow over the kingdom. Over his right to rule, even. It's personal grief, but it's also potentially a political crisis.
So the monk hands over the letter, but the king, he's shaking too much, can't even open it.
Yeah, he's completely overcome. He has to call for a scholar, someone from the Hanlin Academy, to read it out loud.
And the Hanlin Academy, that was like the top intellectual institution, right?
Very prestigious. So getting one of their scholars adds this layer of formality and seriousness to reading this incredibly sensitive letter in front of everyone, officials, empresses, concubines.
Everyone's listening, holding their breath, probably.
And the letter, it's powerful. Starts very formally. She calls herself unfilial daughter by Hua Xiu, kowtowing, showing respect, but also her shame.
Unfilial? That's a heavy word.
Huge. Filial piety, respecting your parents, elders, was absolutely central to their society. So starting like that, she's acknowledging how far she's fallen from that ideal in her eyes.
Then she describes the abduction 13 years back, Mid-Autumn Festival, which is all about family reunion.
Makes it even sadder, yeah.
Palace party, then this sudden fragrant wind and this terrifying demon blue face, red hair, gold eyes just snatches her. Takes her off to some remote mountain cave.
And what she reveals next is deeply troubling. She's been forced to be the demon's wife all this time.
13 years.
And she's had children with him. 2 demonic children. You can feel her shame radiating off the page, can't you?
Yeah. She says revealing it feels like a betrayal of human morality, that it damages society, that she shouldn't even send the letter because it brings disgrace.
It really throws a spotlight on the immense pressure on women back then, their honor, their family's reputation. It was all tied up together.
But she does send it. Why?
Because she desperately misses her parents, and she's terrified of dying without anyone knowing what really happened to her. That fear, that longing, it pushes her past the shame.
And then the connection happens. She mentions meeting the Tang monk.
He'd also been captured by the same demon.
It's this incredible coincidence, this one tiny sliver of hope.
So that's her chance. Exactly. That encounter gives her the courage. She secretly writes the letter, and then pretty bravely, you have to say, she releases the monk and begs him to deliver it.
Her plea is just heartbreaking. Father, send soldiers. Capture this yellow robe demon. Save me.
It shows incredible strength, really. 13 years in that situation, but still holding on to hope, still trying to find a way out.
So the scholar finishes reading. What's the reaction in the court?
Just grief everywhere. The king is weeping loudly. The empresses are crying. The officials are all looking sorrowful. It's this shared moment of shock and sadness for the princess.
And the king wants action, right? Immediately asks for a volunteer. Who will lead an army? Who will fight this demon?
But silence. Complete silence.
Nobody steps up.
No. The description is brutal. Wooden carved military officials and clay molded civil officials.
Hmm.
Just useless statues in the face of this kind of threat. They're terrified.
Can't blame them, maybe. Fighting a demon.
Exactly. The king's getting more and more desperate. Then the officials finally pipe up with an idea.
Okay, what's their brilliant plan?
Well, first they make excuses. They basically say, look, we're just regular guys. We do earthly battles.
Okay.
Swords, spears, you know. We can't fight something that rides clouds and mist.
Fair enough. They know their limits.
So they point the finger. Well, not finger exactly, but they point towards the monk. Their solution is, make the Tang monk do it.
Why him?
Their logic is, well, he's a holy monk from the Upper Kingdom. Even dragons and tigers respect him, apparently.
Mm.
So surely he must have some kind of demon-fighting mojo.
Okay.
They even quote a proverb. He who speaks of right and wrong is himself a person of right and wrong. Kind of implying that because he's involved at all, because he brought the news, he must also have the power to fix it.
Huh. Convenient logic for them.
A little bit, yeah. So they recommend the king entrust the whole rescue mission to the monk. Best course of action, they reckon.
And the king, he's desperate by this point. He jumps on it, makes the monk an incredible offer.
Oh, yeah, a massive offer. He basically says, forget the trip west, catch this demon, bring my daughter back, and you've got it made.
What does he offer, exactly?
Stay here. You can keep your hair, which is a huge deal for a monk. I'll make you my sworn brother. We'll share the throne. You'll have riches. Honor. The works.
He's offering to completely change the monk's entire life and mission.
Absolutely. Just rescue my daughter.
But the monk, he's honest, isn't he?
He is. He basically says, Your Majesty, I just chant scriptures. That's my skill set. Subduing demons. Not really in my wheelhouse.
Which leads the king to ask a pretty sharp question.
Yeah. If you can't handle demons, how on earth are you planning to get to the Western Heaven to see Buddha? That's a good point.
Yeah.
What is the power behind this pilgrimage, if not this?
Cornered. What does the monk say?
He admits, okay, I can't do it, but I have disciples. Two of them. And they are capable.
The backup.
He describes them as being good at opening roads through mountains and building bridges across rivers.
Yeah.
Basically, they're the muscle, the ones who clear the path and protect him.
The king must be thinking, why didn't you lead with that?
Pretty much. He asks why these capable helpers weren't brought to court earlier. Seems like a pretty important detail to leave out.
And the monk's reason?
He was worried about their appearance. He basically says they look, well, terrifying.
How terrifying.
He describes the older one, Zubaji, long pig snout, tusks, bristles, big flapping ears, huge body, fast as the wind.
Okay, not your average courtier.
Not even close. And the second one, Sha Wujing, 12 feet tall, broad arms, blue face, mouth like a bowl of blood, flashing eyes, teeth like nails.
Yikes.
Yeah. The monk was genuinely afraid their looks would freak out the king and the court. It really shows the gap between the sort of refined world of the palace and the wilder, rougher nature of his companions.
But the king, maybe because he's just heard about a child-snatching demon, isn't easily scared anymore.
Not at all. He basically says, you've described them. I know what to expect. Why would I be scared now? Bring them here.
And he sends for them immediately. Orders a golden tablet, like a formal invitation, sent to their guest house.
The king wants to see the Tang monk's disciples.
Right. And how do Pigsy and Sandy react? I mean, do they think, oh, great trouble, or...
Well, that's where it gets interesting. They have totally different takes.
Mm-hmm.
Pigsy, he immediately figures it's because he delivered that letter earlier.
Ah, okay.
And his first thought, reward. Mm-hmm. He's thinking, you know, they're going to get a massive feast out of this. Very Pigsy.
Always thinking about his stomach. What about Sandy? Is he expecting a banquet, too?
Not at all. Sandy's much more, let's say, level-headed. He just says something like, brother, how would we know why? Let's just go.
Hmm. Much more cautious. Less assuming.
Definitely. So they sort out the practical stuff, you know, hand over their luggage, the horse, to the post officials there.
And then head off to the court. Weapons included, right?
Weapons included. Which is probably a good thing, considering what they're usually up against.
Okay, so picture this. They arrive at the royal court. How do they present themselves? Do they do the whole bowing and scraping thing?
Not exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Any sort of traditional court etiquette seems, well, completely lost on them.
Really?
Yeah. Instead of a proper bow, they just offer a quick sound, like nuo. Just an acknowledgement.
Yeah.
And then they just stand there, upright.
Wow. Okay, I can imagine the court officials weren't too thrilled with that.
Oh, definitely not.
Yeah.
The text says they were shocked, muttering about how rude these monks looked, not kowtowing.
And Pigsy being Pigsy. He hears them.
He hears them. And he basically tells them, you know, don't judge so quickly. Admits they might not be easy on the eyes at first.
Trickle a slig.
But give it time. They get easier to look at, he says.
Oh, Pigsy. So blunt. It's funny, but also kind of telling about how little he cares for appearances, maybe.
Or how little self-awareness he has sometimes. But yeah, it's pure Pigsy.
So how's the king taking all this? He sees these two unusual figures. Here's Pigsy's comment.
Well, the king was already pretty startled just by how they looked. The source says he was startled.
Understandable, probably.
But then Pigsy speaks up with that comment about getting better looking. And the king just completely loses it, gets such a fright, he actually falls off his throne,
No way, off the throne.
right off the throne. His attendants have to rush and help him back up.
Goodness, and the Tang monk must be mortified.
Absolutely. He immediately steps in, apologizing profusely for his disciples, their lack of manners.
He gets the courtly stuff, even if they don't.
Exactly. And once the king sort of recovers his composure, he basically says, "Wow, I would have been scared to death if you hadn't warned me about them beforehand."
Okay, so the initial shock starts to fade. The king remembers why he summoned them. He needs help, right?
Right. He gets straight to the point. He asks, "Okay, which one of you two actually knows how to fight demons?"
The million-dollar question.
Pretty much. That's why they're there. The kingdom's got a monster problem.
And let me guess who jumps in first. It's got to be Pigsy.
You got it immediately. Old Pig will subdue them, he boasts. No hesitation.
Zero modesty there. So he steps up. Does he offer any credentials? How does he convince the king he's the pig for the job?
He does give a bit of his backstory. Says he used to be Marshal Tianpeng.
Oh, right, his heavenly past.
Yeah, big deal up in the celestial realm. And explains, he broke some rules, got demoted, and now he's a Buddhist disciple.
Quite the career change.
And then the big claim. He insists he's been the main one fighting demons ever since they started their journey.
Okay, so he's trying to build some confidence. A fallen general turned pig monster slayer. The king must be thinking, what have I gotten myself into?
Probably. But the king latches onto that former celestial general part. He gets curious
About what?
about transformation powers. If he was a heavenly general, can he still do that sort of thing? Change shape.
Ah, okay. And Pigsy?
Pigsy's answer is kind of modest, almost suspiciously so. He says he just about knows a few changes.
Just about a few. Yeah, right. Knowing Pigsy, that sounds like an understatement.
Exactly. So the king, intrigued, asks for a demonstration. But not just any transformation.
He wants a big one, doesn't
A
he?
really big one. And Pigsy is more than happy to oblige. Loves showing off.
So what does he do?
He chants a spell, makes a big gesture, shouts, and boom, he grows. Massively.
Psychic.
Like 8 or 9 zhang tall, which
Oh.
is, what, over 60 feet? Huge, like a giant road-opening deity, the text says.
60 feet in the middle of the royal court. The officials must have been losing their minds.
So completely. The description is great. Trembling with fear, the whole court is dumbstruck. Total chaos, probably.
I bet. Even the guards.
Yeah, even one of the palace generals is apparently so stunned he actually asks Pigsy, is there a limit? How big can you get?
And this is where Pigsy gets really ridiculous, isn't it?
But absolutely classic Pigsy.
Yeah.
His answer makes no sense. He says it depends on the wind direction.
The wind, seriously.
Seriously, he says east wind, west wind, no problem. But if a south wind blows, well, he might just get so big he punches a hole straight through the sky.
He's gonna break the sky because of the wind. Oh my goodness.
It's just so over the top and absurd. Pure Pigsy logic.
The poor king must be thinking, okay, maybe 60 feet is enough.
You bet. He tells him pretty sharply, "Stop. Stop transforming right now." Probably worried about structural damage to the palace or, the heavens.
Yeah, maybe put a pause on the sky punching for now.
So Pigsy shrinks back down. Phew. Crisis averted.
And the king then shifts gears back to the practical stuff, like
Yeah.
weapons.
Exactly. Asks them, "Okay, what do you actually use to fight these demons?"
And Pigsy proudly presents.
His beloved 9-tooth rake, the Dingpa. Pulls out with a flourish, probably.
A rake to fight demons. What's the king's reaction to seeing, well, a farming tool?
He basically laughs, dismisses it completely, says it would spoil the appearance.
Ouch!
Yeah. And then he offers them proper weapons,
Oh!
swords, spears, maces, whips. Anything but the rake, basically.
That's gotta hurt Pixie's pride. He loves that rake.
Oh, he does. And he is not having it. He immediately jumps to defend it.
What does he say?
Calls it his lifelong companion, says it's essential. Goes way back to his Marshal Tianpeng days.
Bringing up the old job again.
Claims he commanded 80,000 naval soldiers in the Heavenly River with this very rake.
80,000. See, you forget, sometimes he wasn't always just Pigsy. He had this incredible past.
Exactly. It adds this whole other dimension. And he insists the rake is amazing for their current mission, too.
How's
he boasts it can smash through mountains, beat tigers, even take down dragons underwater. Says it's been key to all their successes fighting monsters on the journey.
So he gives this passionate speech about his rake. Does it work? Does he convince the king?
It actually does. Hearing about its history, its supposed power, and just Pigsy's sheer confidence, the king is won over.
Really?
Yeah, he's delighted. Says he believes in Pigsy now, ready to put his faith in the pig and his rake.
That's quite a turnaround from falling off the throne in fear.
It really is. Pigsy's weird charisma, maybe.
So to show his newfound faith, the king does something special.
He does. Orders his attendants to bring his own personal wine as a farewell drink for the disciples before they head off to fight the demon.
Wow, the king's personal stash. That's a big honor.
Huge honor. And the king himself pours a cup for Pigsy, promises him a big party, lots of rewards, if he brings the princess back safely.
Okay, so Pigsy gets the royal treatment. How does he react? Does he just down it?
Here's another little surprise. For all his usual rough manners, he actually shows a moment of, well, etiquette.
What does he do?
Before drinking, he offers the first cup to his master, the Tang monk.
Oh, that's actually quite respectful.
It is. Then he drinks his share, saying something like, it'll liven things up for catching monsters. But that little gesture towards the monk is notable.
Yeah, it shows there's still that hierarchy, that respect there underneath the bluster. Okay, so they've had their royal wine. Time to go fight the demon. How do they leave?
Pigsy makes a very Pigsy exit. Just leaves onto a cloud and flies off. Zip.
Leaving the king pretty impressed, I imagine.
Definitely astonished. Flying monks aren't an everyday sight, even for a king.
What about Sandy? Does he fly off too?
Sandy drinks his wine quickly first. But then he actually voices a worry.
A worry. About what?
About Pigsy going alone. He reminds the monk he's concerned Pigsy might need help.
Ah, that's interesting. Sandy, the quiet one, showing that concern for his brother disciple and assessing the threat realistically.
Exactly. It's a nice character moment for Sandy. It shows his loyalty and his pragmatism.
And the Tang monk agrees.
Yes. He recognizes the danger, too.
Yeah.
Tell Sandy, okay, you should go help him.
So Sandy leaves as well.
Yep. Just as quickly, leaps onto his cloud, zooms off after Pigsy.
Leaving the king with.
Just the Tang monk. And the king is suddenly panicking, thinking, wait, don't you leave too?
But the Tang monk can't fly, can he?
Nope. He just has to tell the king, pretty helplessly, that he can't actually go anywhere. He's stuck there.
Shells. A slightly awkward end to the audience. The king's saviors have flown the coop, and he's left with the one guy who can't fly.
Pretty much. A bit anticlimactic for the king, maybe.
Okay, scene change. Sandy finding Pigsy. He tells him, look, the master says we need to do this together.
And Pigsy's reaction.
Oh, he's overjoyed, genuinely thrilled. It's not just relief. It's like, great, the two of us will smash this.
He sounds pretty confident.
Extremely. He even talks about how this is their chance to make a name for themselves in the local kingdom. So right off the bat, you get this feeling of bravado, maybe even overconfidence.
Okay, so this confident duo heads off. How do they arrive? Quietly.
Oh, definitely not. The text makes it sound quite grand, actually. Auspicious clouds, this sort of energy coming from the capital. It's a whole scene.
A dramatic entrance, then.
You could say that.
Yeah.
And then Pigsy, being Pigsy, doesn't just, you know, knock. He takes his rake and just smashes the stone gate of the cave.
Wow, okay. So much for still.
Exactly. Creates this huge hole. You can just picture the monster's minions inside, just completely startled by this very loud, very aggressive arrival.
Right, sets the tone. So the monster comes out. Is he expecting them?
He seems surprised, yeah. Especially since he'd already let their master go earlier. And Pigsy just immediately launches into accusations.
What does he accuse him of?
Well, the big one is kidnapping the third princess of the Boxian Kingdom and supposedly marrying her and keeping her for 13 years.
13 years. Okay, that's specific.
It is. And Pigsy adds that they're acting on the king's direct orders to capture him, trying to make it all official.
How does the monster take that?
Not well. Not well at all. The text gets pretty vivid here. He's grinding his teeth, eyes wide, grabs his steel sword. It escalates, like, instantly.
So swords and rakes and staffs flying.
Pretty much. A fierce battle kicks off right there. The monster with his sword, Pigsy with his rake, and Sandy jumps in with his staff. It's described as this really intense three-way melee.
And it's not just fighting, is it? I think you mentioned verbal sparring, too.
That's a key part. While they're trading blows, they're also trading words. Pigsy keeps hammering on about the princess, the crime, the king's orders.
And the monster.
He's basically dismissing them. Like, who are you to interfere? This is none of your business. He challenges their right to be there at all.
So it's a clash of justifications as much as weapons.
Exactly. It shows you what's really driving each side. And this goes on for several rounds, back and forth, blows and insults.
Okay, so it's a tough fight. Does it stay evenly matched?
Well, this is where things take a turn. The momentum starts to shift. The text specifically mentions Pigsy begins to struggle.
So.
His rake feels heavy, hard to manage. His strength is visibly fading. And then we get this crucial piece of information, sort of an aside in the text.
What's that?
It turns out that earlier, some unseen protective deities were secretly helping Pigsy and Sandy, giving them a bit of a boost.
Uh-huh. Like hidden backup?
Kind of, yeah. But now, those same deities have shifted their focus. They're off protecting the master, who's somewhere else.
So their secret weapon just vanished.
Precisely. That initial advantage they had, maybe without even fully realizing it, it's gone. Now it's just them.
That's a huge shift. It really puts that initial confidence in a different light, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It makes you wonder how much of their early success was actually them and how much was this divine intervention relying on temporary, unseen help. Risky.
Very risky.
Yeah.
So Pigsy realizes he's losing. His backup is gone. What does he do? Stand his ground?
Not exactly. His response is, well, it's certainly something. He realizes he's outmatched and suddenly announces he needs to relieve himself.
Perfect.
Urgently.
Seriously. Mid-fight.
Yep. But it's clearly an excuse. He doesn't just step aside. He makes a run for it, diving into the thick bushes, abandons Sandy completely.
He just leaves him there.
Leaves him there. The text even says he ignores any wounds he might have gotten, just focuses on escaping. He's apparently keeping like half an ear out for the fight sounds, but he is gone.
Wow. Okay, some teammate. What happens to Sandy?
Well, you can imagine. The monster sees Pigsy flee, so he turns all his attention, all his power, onto Sandy.
Who's now facing him alone.
Exactly. And Sandy seems caught totally by surprise by Pigsy just vanishing like that. He's quickly overpowered.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The monster captures him, drags him into the cave, and ties him up, with Sandy captured and his fate totally up in the air.